This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This program contains themes of an adult nature. Word for Word is an in-depth look into the lives of real people, which means this episode may contain explicit accounts of real-life events, including alcohol and drug use. The language used at times may cause some offence, but has been left uncensored due to the accuracy of the story. No offence is intended, and we hope you enjoy the program.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, to over 70 community stations around the nation, this is Word for Word. Coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome family and friends, fans and fiends to today's edition of Word for Word. I want to thank you for tuning in today. I am Benjamin Norris and it's simply a delight to continue to work on this show for the Joy Network, which has already featured some of the community's strongest voices. In the tradition of this ongoing program, I continue to look at powerful stories and insights into the life and lifestyle of some incredible people. Each week we will chat with those in and around our community who have inspired us, entertained us, but mostly they've made an impact on the queer community of Australia. Today our guest is an Australian LGBTI champion. He grew up in regional Victoria and from an early age he followed his dreams to be an Aussie rules footballer. This very passion led him to publicly opening a line of conversation about queer people in sport, and from there he has started a movement now known as Pride Cup Australia. Since then, he has achieved huge success in the space of mental health, and he has his sights set on shaking things up in Australian politics. Amongst many other accolades, he was named as Young Australian of the Year for Victoria, and last month he received a Globe Award on behalf of Pride Cup. I'd like to welcome you, and I'd like to welcome Jason Ball to Word for Word.
I played football since the age of five.
Victorian country footballer Jason Ball says it's time for the big league to promote a message of acceptance.
It became obvious that I was gay, but it was something that my parents didn't ask questions about. Maybe I should speak more directly to the gay players and say, just come the bloody hell out already.
The derogatory slur fag scrawled across posters for openly gay Greens candidate for Higgins, Jason Ball.
Tonight's St Kilda versus Sydney Pride game is about belonging and showing everyone that they are welcome at the football.
Our community were looking for a sign of strength and hope in the face of this intimidation and violence.
The Pride Cup is a country footy match designed to celebrate diversity and promote inclusion for the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender and intersex community in sport.
Can we play a bit of a game to start with?
Yeah.
Okay, so the very first time I met you, you asked me for some advice. But can you try and guess what that advice was?
Can I guess what the advice that I asked you was?
Mm.
I don't know. Was it how to be funny on TV?
No.
I can't remember.
Okay. Well, I feel like we're going to... I'll come back to this. At the end of this podcast.
Okay.
And feel free to keep having guesses along the way because you're never going to guess it.
Okay.
Alrighty. So anyway, straight off the bat, I need to ask you, from the absurd to the hidden truth, what are your answers on why we haven't seen gay men in the AFL?
One of the big things is that no one wants to be first.
Mm.
And I think that there are people who are in that position who might be gay and play AFL who don't want that to be what defines their career. And to be honest, I think that comes from a little bit of internalized homophobia, right? Like, you know, it's as if that would be a bad thing.
Some of the worst homophobes that I know are gay people.
Yeah. Well, especially those who repress it or hide it or feel some sort of shame towards it. And when you've grown up playing football in this very macho environment, you're constantly drilled into you that there is something shameful or wrong about being gay. Not directly, but at least indirectly through the language that people use. You know, the word gay is an insult or to mean bad or weak or soft, or words like faggot and poofter and homo. That's constant, whether, you know, it's coming from over the fence, coming from the opposition, your coach, your own teammates. That language is pervasive and you kind of internalize it. And I know I did. And so that's what I assume. Like, I don't know any gay AFL players. I wish that I did. I wish that they would talk to me and, you know, reach out and say, how can I come out too? Like, I would love that to happen.
Has that never happened to you?
No. But I think that The reason is also the double standard that we have for people in the public eye when it comes to sexuality. So, for people who are gay, they're probably telling themselves, well, that's private. No one needs to know. Mm. You know, it's no one's business what my sexuality is. But we don't hold that same standard for straight people in football. When they bring their girlfriends to the Brownlow Medal Night, that they're not seen as rubbing their heterosexuality in everyone's faces. You know, they're just... Sexuality is a whole lot more than just who you have sex with in privacy. It's about family, it's about love, it's about relationships. These things are all very public.
Mm.
So, I mean, you know, for all of the reasons that I think a gay player hasn't come out, I've got a counterpoint to everyone of why they're wrong and why they should come out, but, you know, it still hasn't happened.
Yeah, you've played that game in your head a few times.
I try not to make it about the players, because sure. No one should be forced out of the closet, and the pressure shouldn't be on them to have to make that environment one where they can feel comfortable to come out. The responsibility is on the AFL, responsibility is on the straight players, the responsibility is on the administration, the fans, to make that culture one where if a player wanted to come out, that they could. And so I focus on everything but the players usually when I'm talking about this issue or doing this advocacy. Maybe I should speak more directly to the gay players and say, just come the bloody hell out already. I don't know.
It looks good over this side of the fence.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to get more into this. So I need to ask you about the origins of Jason Ball.
Uh-huh.
For people out there that might not necessarily know. So, you grew up in regional Victoria.
Yes.
Were you in Christmas Hills?
That's it. Little known Christmas Hills. It has a primary school, but no shops, and it's in the bush. So, it was, yeah, like growing up in a wonderland. I, you know, was surrounded by bush. There was wild kangaroos and echidnas and wombats and everything growing up. I absolutely loved nature as a kid. And so, yeah, it was a small town. Mum and dad had some property. We had like 20 acres, some horses and some cows. Had sort of, I guess you could call it like a hobby farm. Like, we didn't have a lot of animals, but there was like one of each.
And your mum was a teacher and your dad, well, he ran a B&B.
Yes.
What was your relationship like with these parents?
I was probably closer to my mum. My dad, when I was very young, would work very late and leave for work very early. We lived in Christmas Hills, which is about an hour commute from the city. And dad worked in the city when I was growing up. And so, you know, I loved dad and it was exciting when I got to see him. But I spent most of my time with mum. Mum was pick up from school, drop off from school, take me to all my activities that I was doing. But the one thing that dad and I did have together was football. And he loved football, and so he would take me to games on the weekends. And I don't think my dad has ever missed a game of football that I've ever played in my life.
You know, one of my favorite stories that I was told about your dad was that he had the Collingwood Grand Final on, like, VHS, and then didn't he make a sound recording so he could have it on cassette and you would drive around in the car listening to
yeah,
it?
Yeah, he had the official cassette tape of the 1990 Collingwood Grand Final, like the call of the game, right? Because it's a different experience listening to the call. It's different people who did the commentary on the TV who did it on ABC Grandstand. And so, he had both. So, he could relive that experience over. It was a 32-year premiership drought for Collingwood. And so, I remember when I was a kid, actually, because it was the most watched video in our house. But I remember when I first, like, discovered it, I was like, oh, this is a Collingwood game. And it's Essendon Grand Final. And I was like, oh, let's watch it. And I was like, who wins? I was really excited while I was watching. I was like, why would dad own a video if Collingwood didn't win it at the end? But growing up, I was indoctrinated into the Collingwood Football Club. I didn't have a choice of who I went for. I wanted to barrack for West Coast because there was a guy called Jason Ball who also played for West Coast who went on to play for Sydney. My dad was fine with me being gay, but if I'd barracked for any other team than Collingwood, I would have been kicked out of home. So, I didn't have much say in that.
So, how many siblings did you have? How many siblings did you have growing up?
I had a younger sister.
And what's your relationship like with her?
We get along. We didn't get along when we were kids. We fought a lot.
Sibling rivalry.
Yes, there was a lot of sibling rivalry. There was a lot of her coming along and getting more attention than I liked when she was born, and so there was a lot of jealousy, I think. And we fought a lot growing up. And at some point, I don't know, I matured at some point, and I was like, I don't have to fight with her all the time. Why don't I just be nice to her? And then we got along great.
Logic prevails.
Yeah.
You know, I think as you're growing up, you know, some of those aha moments means that those people who challenged you the most growing up become your biggest allies.
Oh, absolutely.
Which I love. So can you describe to me Jason Ball as a little kid?
Jason Ball as a little kid. I mean, I played football since the age of 5. In Yarra Glen, it was quite a small town and I think they needed extra numbers, so they threw me straight into the under-10s. And so for the first few years, I didn't even get a kick while playing. And actually, I was being the forward pocket, and Yarra Glen was such a bad team back then that we never scored at all. And so I'd just be in the forward pocket playing in the grass and doing cartwheels. But as I got older and like I was competitive and I got stronger and taller, I was really good at football and took home the best and fairest at Yarra Glen all through like under 10s and 12s and 14s and became the thing that I was good at. But, you know, also when I was very young, I did ballet and...
See, that shocks me. That's what shocks me.
Acrobatics, yeah. So I remember my dad told me that James Heard did ballet as well as football, and it's what gave him his great balance. And so...
He stamped approval on it.
Yeah, he kind of got approval from dad, so I did it. But then by the time I got a bit older and, you know, the other boys found out about it at school, I got bullied about it, and so I eventually gave it up and just stuck with football. But I enjoyed it.
If I asked you to do a pirouette now...
Absolutely not. I'm the least flexible person. I don't know. Yeah, definitely not.
I'm the same with the Spanish I learnt around that same era. My Spanish, no comprende. Interestingly enough, it was that you were not just passionate about football, you were actually really good at it as well. And does that mean that that saved you in some way with the kids at school? Do they less likely to think Jason's gay because of his ability with sport?
Yeah, I think that I definitely had that as a feather in my cap, as cred, I guess, on the playground, you could say.
Maybe a shield.
Yeah, and I think that I threw myself into it a lot during those teenage years because it was a bit of reinforcing myself and convincing myself that that was the masculine, blokey thing to do. And I think as I started to come to terms with my sexuality, I still always wanted to hang on to the football because I kind of wanted to prove myself and other people wrong in a way.
If I'm going to be gay, that's okay because I'm also a really good footballer, which is a man's sport.
Yeah. Didn't want to be the stereotype, I guess. I wanted to break that. I wanted to show that I was different. And I also knew that it would be the one thing where I'd probably always get respect from my dad. And so it made him happy that I was playing football. And so it was the thing when I pulled out of playing, potentially getting drafted to the AFL, that kind of broke my dad's heart, was sort of the moment where I kind of let go of this notion that I had to be doing football to get my dad's approval, I guess.
But at this particular age, you chose to leave football and then go and do a student exchange, an international student exchange. Had you worked out your sexuality before making that decision?
I had. And I think that was probably where the tipping point came for me, because I didn't feel like I fit in. I needed some kind of circuit breaker. I needed to get away. And so this idea of going on a student exchange, it's like you're starting fresh in a new place and no one knows you, and you can kind of create your own story about who you are. There's no baggage. And so I was so drawn to this idea of going on student exchange and experiencing something different and just getting away. It meant at the time, because I'd just been drafted to train with the Eastern Rangers, who play in the TAC Cup, which is sort of that step before AFL football. But the exchange year, it was either now or never for when I did that. And my dad was like, this is your chance to get... Like, he was trying to encourage me to not go on exchange so that I could be part of this training camp and potentially get recruited to the AFL. And I just had to make a call. And I was like, I want to go on exchange. I don't want to be an AFL footballer. Part of me felt that I probably wasn't good enough, you know, and I was worried maybe that I'd disappoint my dad even if I stayed and did football. But I think also, you know, part of me felt that because I was gay, that it was just going to be too hard. There was no such thing as a gay footballer. I wouldn't be able, like, I didn't want to live a lie. I didn't want to have to hide who I was. That was what I was really struggling with now at the age of 15 or 16, let alone for the rest of my life. And so something had to give.
Two things. Did you going overseas, do you regret that at all?
No, I really enjoyed that experience and it kind of shaped me in a lot of ways. I don't regret it at all. And I don't look back and wish that I pursued a career in AFL either. I've always felt a little bit of an odd one out within the footy culture. I wanted to travel. I wanted to study. I'm not the typical footy player. Like, I didn't get along with my footy mates in the same way that they all got along with each other. They're all tradies. They want to talk about chicks and cars, and I just didn't want to talk about that stuff. Like, going on footy trips was just like hell, because they wanted to go to the strippers. I just wanted to get really drunk and be gross, and it's just like...
And you were suggesting High School Musical too.
Yeah.
The second question that I have for you then is, what was that experience? What did that do to you?
It gave me so much perspective, because I had grown up in this bubble and thinking that the way that things are done are just the way that it is. But going overseas, I really saw that when I went overseas, I was in Kansas in the United States. So, the buckle of the Bible Belt, very conservative area. And I saw how much people's attitudes there were literally shaped by their surroundings. Mm. And it made me really question all of my own attitudes towards life, and realize that if I had of by chance grown up in a completely different place, I'd probably have a completely different outlook on life. And it was sort of this really grounding moment where I kind of, I don't know, it's hard to describe. I had this perspective on life where I realized that I guess I felt really lucky to be alive and to have the things that I had and to have the family and the friends that I had and be in the city that I was in. And it was this sense of gratitude, and also this sense that, like, I'm only gonna live one time, and so I get one shot at life, and that if there is no God or meaning to life, then I've got to create that meaning for myself. And I kind of came back to Australia so much more motivated to be myself and to be genuine about things, but also, I guess, with a real passion for knowledge and understanding other people and being switched on about what's going on in the rest of the world. And so it was a real awakening for me, I suppose, in a lot of ways, which I'm grateful for.
Did you get to have like an affirmation about your sexuality over there and then come back to Australia being comfortable about that? Or was it still a while before you came out to your friends and family?
I hadn't come out to my family when I left to go overseas. And when I was over there, because Kansas was such a conservative area, it was the same. I was there while they voted in an election to ban gay marriage, like overwhelmingly. And so topics around homosexuality were really common. I was off to church and youth group because that's just what they did over there. And it was about experiencing a different culture. So I just went along. But it was very homophobic. And so I didn't talk to anyone about my sexuality. That kind of became the last thing about my identity or about on my mind. And I instead got really focused on what they were doing. And so I became really invested in debates about science versus religion and whether God exists and the environment. And though those were the questions that, you know, were being explored there. And so I kind of put my sexuality or worrying about that on hold while I was over there. And, you know, I didn't meet anyone who was gay over there. It was kind of the break that I needed, actually.
How long was it after you got back that you returned to the sport?
So, I came back, and it took me 2 years before I went back and reunited with Yarra Glen. That's what I focused so much of my advocacy on, is everything that I've done with Yarra Glen. So, I almost have erased the little bits and pieces that happened between that. But when I came back and I was in year 12, I actually went and ended up playing under 18s for Ringwood, which is where my dad played footy, at the same time as playing school football for Yarra Valley Grammar. So, I was playing two games of football every weekend. And then I went to uni and was living and studying in the city. And then I got a call from Yarra Glen, who I'd played junior football with. And they knew I wasn't playing football at the time. And they were like, come back and play your senior footy at your old club. And I was like, all right, let's do it. And I knew a lot of the guys because I'd played junior football with them. And mum and dad would feed me after football practice, which was a good deal as a uni student. So, you know, that was good. But, you know, nowhere through my school football or playing for Ringwood or when I came back for Yarra Glen for the first few years, I wasn't out to anyone.
So then with your parents, what age was it when you decided to come out with them, and what was that experience like for you?
So when it comes to coming out to my parents, I had taken the approach that, oh, if my sister doesn't have to come out as straight, then I don't have to come out as gay, which was code for I'm petrified they're going to be disappointed in some way. And so I want to try and avoid that question and never bring it up. And I remember at times my parents would sort of reach out to me to sort of say hinting things like, do you want to talk to us about anything? Because I was bringing guys home, but I just, like, it wasn't clear whether my friend or whether something was going on. And I think back to that time and I really regret not actually sitting down and telling them, because it became obvious that I was gay, but it was something that my parents didn't ask questions about. I'd kind of trained them to not talk about it because I was just, I think deep down, I was really, there was some kind of fear that they were going to be disappointed, but it had gone on too long that they kind of knew, but it was this elephant in the room that we didn't mention or talk about. And I eventually, like, I hated that. And it wasn't until I decided to come out in the media that I actually sat mum and dad down and said, you know how I'm gay? And they were like, yes. And I'm like, well, I'm going to be coming out in the newspaper on the weekend. And
a package deal that.
Yeah. And that my story in the paper was me coming out to my extended family, to my aunts and uncles and to my grandparents.
In one go.
And that was amazing because I got messages from them to say that they loved me, they were really proud of me, they had no idea that I'd struggled in the way that I had, which was wonderful. But I remember with my first partner, when he had sat down with his mum and dad and told them that he was gay at the age of 16, and, you know, the mum cried for a week, but then she got over it and it was fine. And when I went to his house, I was introduced as his boyfriend. I was made to feel part of the family. We could talk about anything over dinner. But when he came to my house, it was like silence. And there was this unspoken, like, is he your friend or boyfriend? We don't really know. We couldn't really talk about anything. And I wondered what he had with his family and his parents. But it was like, it felt like it was too late now. It's going to be awkward if I say I'm gay because they kind of know. But that's kind of the lesson that I try and impart to young people when I have the opportunity to speak at schools to kids who are gay. And it's like, coming out will be the best thing you'll ever do, and you'll always wish that you'd done it sooner. And I do. That's my experience.
Who was it that was in your circle at that time who convinced you to tell that story?
So this came about from Tom Ballard, who I had met. And he, at the time, Change.org had just started up in Australia. And Tom did one of the first petitions on Change.org. It was something about homophobia or something like that. And at the time, there was an incident that had happened in the AFL where a player was heard issuing a homophobic slur to another player, but he had gotten off on a lot lesser penalty than, like, a racist slur. So, there's a lot of commentary happening in the world of AFL about homophobia. And Change.org wanted to do a petition calling on the AFL to do more to tackle homophobia. And they knew Tom because he'd done their first petition. And they said to Tom, they're like, do you know any gay footballers who might be interested in being the face of this petition? And Tom was like, actually, I do know someone who was gay and played football. And at the time, I was out to all my friends knew that I played football, but I was also out to my teammates at the time. That had been a relatively new thing, but they were great with it, which was amazing. But I never thought that was a big deal. Like, I was like, I'm just a country footy player. I've not played AFL at the elite level. That's not a story. And then Change.org approached me and they said, we want to run this campaign. We need a story to kind of get the hook. We need a face for the campaign. You know, what are your opinions on this issue? Would you be interested in being the face of this campaign? And I was like, well, if you think it'll help, sure. Like, I'll put my name to it. I'll share my story. If that'll help the AFL take action, then let's do it. And so we then got into a bit of planning and they gave me a little bit of media training, very limited media training.
But still, they gave you some. That's good.
It helped. Like, Change.org, you know, currently Sally Rugg and Nick Hollis and stuff work for them. They do amazing work behind the scenes of that organization to get these campaigns up and running and to win those campaigns. And that started right from the start of Change.org. And I was one of the biggest petitions at the time that had ever run on the site because it really took off.
Well, it resonated. You were playing football. You were good at Aussie rules. And you're a gay man.
it really hadn't dawned on me that that was a story. And even when we had the Sunday Age article lined up, I thought that would have been it. Like, I didn't think that there'd be any other media coverage in it.
Mm.
But how the actual article on the Age came about, it was actually, there's a connection here through Joy FM, because they were trying to decide whether they give this story to the Age or the Herald Sun. And that journalist was Jill Stark, who we've gone on to become great friends. She's won Straight Ally of the Year at the Globe Awards. And, you know, she's absolutely, she's written a couple of books. So that was how my story ended up being published in the Sunday Age. And then that day, it was a Sunday before our grand final the week after. And so we had a training session. And so change.org were like, great, like, we'll send out a media alert. Camera crews can go down and they can actually get footage of you on the day that your story comes out, of you kicking a football and being with your teammates and stuff like that. And I was still like, oh, I don't know if they'd really want to come and do that. It's all in Yarra Glen. And then all four television networks were there at football practice filming me. They wanted to interview my teammates. And then that afternoon, I was on 3AW and I was on 774. And then the next day, I was on Sunrise, and it just went from there.
Well, thank God for that small amount of media training.
If you go back over some of those interviews, though, I was pretty rusty.
Do you know what's sad about this in some ways, though, was there was a lot of people talking about the fact that you weren't an AFL footballer, and there was a bit of backlash over, is he looking for notoriety? And how did you cope with the backlash of people saying to you, are you just an attention seeker?
Well, for people who don't know AFL, they would say, oh, an AFL player has come out. And it's like, for those of us who do, it's like, you wouldn't say AFL because that implies you play at the elite level. You'd say Aussie rules footballer, right? And so constantly I was being misreported in the news as being an AFL footballer, or they were promoting me as being more important than I was. And I would have to go and try and correct them. But a lot of people were seeing that and thinking that I was lying. Like, I was trying to pretend that I was an AFL footballer in order to get attention.
Did that hurt?
I mean, I was fine. I mean, the thing was, is this got so much media, and because there was a petition attached to it, all the media was like, go sign this petition, go sign this petition. And at the bottom of the petition, change.org created like a dummy email account. If anyone wanted to share their story as well or get in touch, and I ended up getting about 1,000 emails in that, which I didn't get time to read until weeks later. And it was amazing. Like, there was 2% negative, 98% positive people sharing their stories, people saying how much it meant to read a story of a player who was gay within the sport of Aussie rules that they love so much, and they felt less alone. So even though there were some people out there saying that I was just trying to get attention, or, you know, some people would say, I don't care if you're gay, just don't go on about it. Why are you trying to become famous over this? But at the same time, I was getting emails and emails of people telling me how much it meant to them. Like, they were saying, like, thank you. And so that was more overwhelming than any of the negative or the naysayers. And so for me, that's what drove me to keep doing it. Like, because I was getting feedback that it was making a difference for people, that they felt comfortable to come out to their parents because they'd read my story, or that they felt comfortable to come out to their football team even.
You know, if you're going to be an instigator of change, or you're going to make an impact on people, my mum has this story where she saw this hate online for me when I started having a media profile. And mum rang the people from Channel 9 and she was like, oh my God, these people are saying this horrible stuff about my son. And they said to her, you know, Jane, for everyone who has a negative thing to say about Ben, there is hundreds of people that like him. And that's the conversion rate for someone who's making an impact. And I think it's the collateral damage of you making an impact. And I guess you can't let that hold you back. So 2012, around this time, you reached out to some AFL footballers and also some teammates that you were playing with, and they joined you to lead the Pride March, which was very powerful. Where did you find these people?
It was so special. Like, the story kept picking up. Like, every week there was something new, because we had this petition where I was had specific asks of the AFL, like, show no to homophobia ads on the big screen, have a Pride game, that sort of stuff. Then when we got those wins, that was a whole other story and a whole another round of news on radio and on TV and on the newspaper that, oh, the AFL were going to show no to homophobia ads on the big screen, or the AFL are going to invest in education programs to tackle homophobia. And then when I was invited to lead Pride March, that was obviously a huge honour, but for me, the heroes of that story, 100%, are my teammates from Yarra Glen and the two AFL players, Daniel Jackson and Brock McLean, who came and marched by my side. And, you know, they were the first AFL players to ever take part in this event. So it got probably the biggest media coverage that Pride March had had for many years. And it was a really significant moment, I think, to have not only people who were straight, but to have footy boys march in a gay pride march. You know, that broke down all of those stereotypes. And I think it gave permission to other people in our community, especially young men, to know that saying no to homophobia doesn't make you less of a man. It means that you're a good bloke. It means that you're sticking up for your mates. Mm. You know, that was what that day represented. And it was splashed across the Herald Sun. It was on all the nightly news. I think it was on Sky News later that night, my last interview for the day with Brock McLean, who was on there like a bloody legend. And Brock McLean, the player from Carlton, he was the one who I'd heard of media people within the AFL trying to stop this from happening, right? So it was the Carlton Football Club who later went on to not support marriage equality at that critical time. If you want to look at a club that has some culture issues, who I've got some things to say about, it's that club. But Brock McLean was such a legend because he has a gay sister. And so for him, this was personal. And it was, I think it was actually Jill Stark who did a tweet on Twitter to say, when are some AFL players going to come out and back up Jason? Because it has been weeks now. For the first few months after I shared my story, not a single AFL player said anything in response to it, other than former AFL player Jason Ackermanis, who attacked me. In response to that, people like tweeted at Jason Ackermanis, and someone started up a hashtag. The story there is that in response to my story, Jason Ackermanis tweeted, "Who cares?" or something like that. And I think he took it personally that I'd come out and launched a campaign to call on the AFL to do more to tackle homophobic. So he was kind of thinking this was all an attack on him.
I love these people who are like egomaniacs, because, you know, something that you've done, which is powerful and also amazing, is a personal attack on his whole life.
Yeah.
I mean, no.
And so people used the hashtag WeCareJason, and people were sending him tweets about why they did care, why they thought this issue was important, why they were proud of me for the stand that I was taking. And it like started trending on Twitter. And the next day, Jason Ackermanis deleted his Twitter account completely. So if I've achieved one thing during my time,
you've saved us from
Jason Ackermanis on Twitter.
I think it's a good time to ask you this question, because you've achieved so much at this point of your life. You know, looking back, is there any advice that you would give to Jason at the age of 12 if you had that opportunity? So let's just say I open the door here and in comes Jason Ball at 12. What do you say to Jason?
I think, you know, I mean, there's that story about my parents and understanding that coming out to your parents is not going to turn them away from you. It's going to bring you closer to them, and your relationship's going to be stronger for it. But I think even before that moment, at the age of 12, what I needed to hear was, don't be afraid to be who you are, and that you'll be surprised how accepting other people in your life are going to be if you give them the chance, like your teammates at the Yarra Glen Football Club. And to think that one day they're going to march by your side at Pride March, that would have, I would have
blown,
told myself to go home. And
he's Spider-Man jocks off.
Absolutely. And, you know, and I would say, you know, at that age, I was wishing that I wasn't gay. And I would go back and say, like, even now, if I had the choice, I wouldn't change who I am. You know, being gay doesn't define me, but it's part of who I am. I'm proud to be myself.
One of my favorite things, because I've seen you speak publicly a few times, is the story of you coming to terms with how you were going to talk to the other players. And one of the other players at the end of the match just asking you, you know, Jason, do you have a partner? Can you tell us that story?
To set the scene for you, picture like someone living a complete double life, right? You're out in all other parts of your life at work and at university, but the football club, you're completely in the closet. And so that means that when you're in that environment, you're second guessing everything that you say or do. You try not to get involved in conversations about relationships or even what you're doing on the weekend out of fear that they might figure it out or you might say something. I had a separate Facebook list so that just my football teammates were, their settings were so that they wouldn't see photos I was tagged in, places I was checked into, what my relationship status was. Like, I was that afraid that them finding out would be the end of my time playing football, that I'd be treated differently, that I'd be bullied, that I'd get kicked off the team. And so that was the situation that I was in, but I sort of had made a promise to myself that if I was ever asked about it or confronted with it, that I wouldn't lie. I wouldn't say, no, I'm actually straight, because lying is just exhausting. And when it came to making up stories about girls, firstly, I had no idea what I was talking about anyway, and maintaining those fabricated stories is a nightmare. And so the first time that it came up in conversation, I suppose, was I was 22 years old. After training one night, we're in the club rooms, and one of my teammates had broken up with his girlfriend. And I, because I knew both of them, I asked him what had happened and how he was doing. And after a bit of back and forth, he didn't want to talk about it anymore. So he's like, "What about you, Bawley? Aren't you seeing someone at the moment?" And I was like, "Yeah, I'm seeing someone." And I would use words like they and them instead of he or she to try and be truthful but get around it. And my teammate just responded and said, "Well, what's his name?" And my heart just stopped, and I was like, maybe he's joking. I just said, his name is James. And my teammate said, has he come to any football matches yet? And I was like, no, he hasn't. And he said, oh, well, you should bring him down. It'd be really great to meet him. And that was just like a massive weight getting lifted off my shoulders. And at this moment, you know, all of the fears that I had in my head about how they were going to react to me just weren't realized. And I felt at the same time silly for thinking that I'd had to hide it for so long and going to those lengths that I'd hidden it.
Mm.
But at the same time, I came to this realization that so much of the homophobia in this environment wasn't coming from a place of hatred towards me or towards gay people, but it was just coming from ignorance, and they weren't even thinking about what they were saying. They certainly didn't know that it was having a negative impact on one of their own teammates. And these conversations kept happening. Like, it turned out after 10 years, there was only so much that I could hide. One of the guys I went to uni with started playing football for the Twos at Yarra Glen, and he, because I went to uni with him when I was out there, he just thought everyone at the club knew. But they just weren't talking about it. And then so it kind of got around, and he spoke to this guy, and then he'd realized that, like, I was gay, but I was trying to hide it, or I didn't want to talk about it. He just wanted to say, it's okay. We don't care. That was his way of doing that. And then those conversations kept happening in my football club. Like, I'd have other teammates sort of reach out to me to say something to indicate that they knew and that they didn't care. And that never felt more part of the football club than I had in my whole life. I could be my whole self. I could talk to them about anything. It was like this new version of what it was like to be in this environment.
Jason Ball 2.0. And did James come along and watch your games from then on?
Yes, he did. He came to the... This was near the end of the season. He came to, like, the...
I'd be so nervous if I was James the first time he came.
So he wanted to come, like, up
and you'd been shunning
him? And I'd been telling him, I'm like, I'm sorry. Bastard. I'm like, it's the only way... I'm like, they won't understand. Like, a lot of them don't know anyone who's gay. They will think negative stuff. I don't know what'll happen. I just can't, like, you just can't come. And
I think the reality in that situation is more that you weren't ready.
Oh, 100%. Like, I was putting it on them, but the reality was that, yeah, I was too scared. And
what do you think makes a good activist? Because all of these things at this point in your life have culminated, and you've found a voice, you've been in the paper, you've had some media exposure. What makes a good activist?
Is someone who is willing to educate themselves and take in other people's perspectives and ideas and try to be doing your best by the people who came before you in the community. I wanted to be able to talk about the T and the I and the L and the B, which were not my experiences. And so I needed to be able to acknowledge that, but I needed to be able to learn a bit about what are the important issues for them. If I'm going to say LGBTI, I need to know what that means. I need to know what are their unique challenges within this space and how I can also advocate for them in the best way that I can as an ally. Just like we're expecting straight people to be good allies for us, like as the G's in the alphabet soup, and as probably the ones in positions of power and privilege in our community, like we absolutely have a role to give a hand up and to sometimes take a step back as well. But at the same time, I think, and with everything, when there's stereotypes, you kind of got to get to the heart of why those stereotypes exist and kind of deconstruct them. And I think for me, I can understand why some people confuse bisexuality as being a phase is because for so many gay men, myself included, we used bisexual as a kind of an easier way to come out when we were younger. Like for a lot of people, there was sort of, well, if I tell my parents that I'm bi, well, I'm not really, but if I tell them that, then maybe they'll hold on to some kind of hope that they might still have grandchildren. And so, like, we only have ourselves to blame that the community, the rest of the community out there, think that being gay is a phase because they've watched so many gay men come out as bi and then later say, well, I'm actually not really
bisexual.
Well,
you know, you got me on this one because that's what I did. I rang my mum and was like, can you come and meet me at Turek Village? We're going to have lunch at this cafe. Apparently, spoiler alert, she like rang my brother and said, Ben's going to tell me he's gay. Anyway, and yeah, I went to this cafe and I said to mum, Mum, I have to tell you that I'm bisexual. And she straight away was like, your dad's cousin's gay. And started telling me about my dad's cousin, Randall, in a really positive light.
Yeah.
And that, she told me later on, was her way of saying, you're not really bisexual, are you?
Yeah, you don't have to soften the blow, no, Ben. You don't have to soften the blow.
We worked it out when you were six.
So did my
parents. And you dressed up as Catwoman and you danced and you danced around the lounge room. We got it. We didn't miss it.
But I think, you know, for the bi community, I think telling that story is a way to give people permission that they have thought that about the bi community. But at the same time, we need to break that down and let those people who are bi be their true selves and not have to deal with those stereotypes. And, you know, coming out and being this advocate in this space has taken completely changed the course of my life. And I now have opportunities to go and do awareness training around LGBTIQ for sporting clubs and for schools. And so I've had to go far beyond just what I was trying to do in the media. But like now I really need to know the difference between sexuality and gender identity and what is the full spectrum of gender identity and talking about non-binary and gender fluid experiences. And so much of that is about them sharing their stories. And so you have to acknowledge that, like, this is not my experience, but let me tell you a story about someone I know and let me tell you what their experience was like and put yourselves in their shoes. Because I think that's what I found people really resonated with my story is because it was a human story. And so they were able to, for a moment, put themselves into my shoes, or at least put themselves into the shoes of my teammates or my dad. They could see themselves reflected in their story and they kind of understood it. And so I think with all education, it has to be through the vehicle of people's stories.
Well, I think as being any leader of social change, it is about sharing your stories. There's lots of people who might not be ready to share their story. And it's important for those people to hear people who can, because that is a leader of social change. I know that you went and knocked on the door quite a bit with the AFL to try and get a job there. And you were knocked back a couple of times.
Yeah, well, I mean, it wasn't so much that I was trying to get myself a job at the AFL, but I at least wanted to see that the AFL were going to invest something in LGBTI as a pillar of their diversity strategy, right? Like the AFL put so much into Indigenous and women and multicultural. They've got a disability league, and rightly so. That's all really important, but they didn't spend a cent on LGBTI. And so I was trying to create this new sector that didn't really exist yet. And I was looking to the AFL for leadership to do it in the same way that they have on other issues. And at the time, this was 2015. It had been 3 years since I came out. Like it had been 3 years of me in my spare time doing this advocacy. And I was like, this isn't sustainable. Like I can't, like I need to get paid to do all this great work that the AFL should really be supporting, if not me, someone, or if not, you know, a team of people. And so I was saying to the AFL, I was like, are you going to actually invest in this? I've been saying, you need to be running education programs. You could be doing all of these things. If not me, someone, you need to do something. And the AFL were just coming back with nothing. And so at that time, I kind of felt like, well, I've done all I can to try and get them to move on this issue. And I'd been tapped on the shoulder by the Greens. And they said that, you know, you have a great profile, the seat that you live in, we think that we can win. If not this election, maybe the one after. And I was ready at that time to talk about other issues. Like, I'd talked a lot about gay footballers for 3 years.
Now we need to talk about science and environment.
Yeah, climate change and asylum seekers. And I was a student of politics at the University of Melbourne. Like, there's more to me than just being a gay footballer. I care about other things. And if I've, in the skills that I have gained in communication and media and stuff by being this role, if I can then apply that on a much broader perspective by being a candidate in an election, maybe I too can inspire people, bring people on that journey, communicate an issue, get people to change their mind on other issues than just this very niche issue of LGBTI inclusion in sport, even though that was my passion. And so that was the junction that I was at. And the conversation with the AFL, when I told them about this idea, they were like, don't go into politics. You're too good for politics. And I was like, in one way, that was a compliment. But at the same time, I was like, is that really the standard that we have come to expect of our politicians? That they lack integrity, that they're just in it for themselves? And I'm like, we can do better than that. Like, we should be able to trust our politicians. And it was along with that, plus the fact that we need people to be leaders on climate change, that it's a disgrace what's happening on Manus Island and Nauru. I was like, well, I want to go out there and be that voice. And I was ready to do something different. And why not be a candidate in an election?
What did politics teach you?
That experience, my first campaign, taught me the power of people power and coming together. The Greens, because they don't have the big money of the major parties, they refuse to take donations from vested corporate interests who are looking to buy influence over policy. They have to rely on individuals who share their vision and their values, who are willing to go out and have conversations with everyday voters. And that's how you change hearts and minds. So much more effective than an ad on TV or a flyer on someone's letterbox is an actual conversation you have with another voter on their doorstep. And being able to roll that out on a big scale with hundreds of volunteers targeting one electorate can see you get a big swing, which we did get in 2016.
From so much of all of this, though, you have had a lot of ambassadorships where you've been able to speak on behalf of Beyond Blue. But the thing that stays with me is that you were an ambassador from 2014 to 15 on Safe Schools. How personal did it feel to see the deconstruction of Safe Schools throughout the media?
Yeah, it was awful. That program had so much potential and bipartisan support once upon a time.
It seemed like a necessity.
Yeah, I felt that finally we've moved past the culture wars when this was rolled out. And I remember I spoke at their first national convention when they just secured all the federal funding, and it was opened by both Labor and Liberal politicians. And I was like, great, like finally we can just go out there and do the work that is needed to do to make sure that homophobia and transphobia are not a commonplace in schools, and so that LGBTI kids have all the same opportunities as everyone else to learn without being bullied. In some sense as well, from my experience in America and knowing how much issues around sexuality and identity can be used as a weapon by like the religious culture wars, it was heartbreaking to see it be attacked. But I think it fundamentally, the reason that they didn't win that war was because the people behind Safe Schools, they seem to be really silenced in fighting back. Mm. Like there wasn't, like Roz Ward, for example, who I have immense respect for, who was leading that program. Like, she was told by Arches or La Trobe University or whatever research center was, or I think it was actually at the time Foundation for Young Australians, was sort of, you know, a very conservative sort of don't rock the boat style organization, was not letting them fight back or speak out. And And I think at the end of the day, they lost the arguments because they weren't able to defend themselves in these attacks. Their strategy was don't respond, it'll just go away, and it didn't go away. And by the time that they could fight back, it was too late.
Let's just say you and I are sitting here right now. Let's just say we're sitting here right now and we're going to give Scott Morrison a phone call and he's going to listen to us for 5 minutes. I'm going to obviously say, Jason Boyle, you're smarter than me. You can do all the talking. I'll dial the phone and you do the talking. What would you say to him?
That's
hard. Here's me dialing the phone. Here you go. Phone call.
Hi, Scott. This is Jason Boyle. I am lucky enough to be Young Australian of the Year for Victoria this year. I'm also a proud gay man and advocate for the LGBTIQ community. And I just have to say that I was incredibly, incredibly disappointed to see you tweet articles about the Daily Telegraph using some misinterpreted statistics about trans people and to suggest that people going into schools telling kids that it's okay to be trans are somehow gender whisperers. I really feel like you know what you're doing here. But I don't think that you're going to win. I think that the Australian people are sick of it. I think that we have achieved marriage equality. And when we said that we want equality for all people, that's what we meant.
But Jason, just to quickly clarify something, I'm so out of touch with reality. I don't know what you're talking about. Please enjoy your day. Goodbye, sir. Never call me on this phone again. Look, I think absolutely everything that you're saying.
Though, I'd try and grandstand in some way if I had an opportunity to talk to Scott Morrison, but I'd probably freeze if I was put in the moment as you did with me just now. I think that, you know,
you did a great job.
The gender whisperers, whether it's the current religious exemptions where they'll try and enshrine laws for religious schools to be able to expel gay students or fire teachers who are gay. You know, this is what motivates this guy who is our Prime Minister, and that is sickening. He said in response to gay conversion therapy that, oh, it's no big deal to him. Like, so many people have committed suicide because of these practices. Oh, it's no big deal to me. It's not on my radar. I don't care about it. This guy is leading our country. Like, it is terrifying for our community.
Before we finish up, for people out there that might not necessarily have heard what Pride Cup Australia is, how do you explain what you're doing there?
Well, what started in Yarra Glen, in my teammates showing their support for me by pulling on rainbow jumpers and creating a 50-metre line in rainbow colours to challenge homophobia and to tell people across our community that you don't have to choose between being yourself and playing the game that you love. That has now grown from that one game in Yarra Glen to 5 years later, 13 games across Victoria in country towns like Gippsland and Hamilton and Geelong and Shepparton. And we're only just getting started. There are more communities across the country who are ready to do a Pride Cup and sort of use the power of sport, which is so powerful, especially in regional towns in country Australia, to send a message of acceptance, to challenge homophobia. And so we've created a new non-profit organisation, Pride Cup Australia, with the view to help any sporting club at any code, at any level, to host their own Pride Cup.
Amazing. What's next for you?
I will be standing again as the Greens candidate for Higgins in the 2019 federal election, which is most likely going to be in May. And off the back of the foundation that we ran in the seat last time, where we got an 8.5% swing, this time, if we were to get another 8% swing, we would win the seat. That is less than half of what Karen Phelps got to win Wentworth.
I saw that tweet of you putting that out there.
I am putting that out there. The blue ribbon has officially been cut. It's anyone's game. And I think a lot of people are putting their hopes in the Greens because we need leaders on climate change, because we need a different solution to the current situation of locking up kids and their children in Manus Island and Nauru. And what we've seen with Wentworth and the changes that we have seen in government policy because of one seat in a balance of power situation, you know, we can really turn things around in this country. And that's what I'm hoping we can do in Higgins.
Have you got a message for the queer community that might be listening to this right now?
Keep an eye out for the Pride Cup. Like, I really think that we are on the start of something really big in this country. We have ambitions to expand into rugby and hockey and cricket, not just Aussie rules football. We want to go national. And so for our community out there, if you grew up in a regional town and you didn't have a great time coming out in that town and you moved to the city, have a look on our website, and that town might actually be holding a Pride Cup in 2019. And I encourage you to go back to that town, and you will be greeted with rainbow messages in every shop window. And you can go to your first ever country football game and feel welcome and feel embraced. And I think that that is just such a wonderful healing experience. It has been for many people from towns like Hamilton and Shepparton. And so it's really the power of sport, I think, especially in Australia, in the sporting loving nation we are, that can bring people together.
Well, Jason, you have done an amazing job, and you have so many people looking up to you, probably coming to you and asking you for advice. So as I mentioned at the start of this interview, when I first met you, you asked for some advice and you wanted to know if I could help in any way you finding a boyfriend who looked like Zac Efron.
Heaven.
I know. You wrote that to me on Facebook at 11:20 at night, and I still have a screen grab of it, so I can prove it to you.
Like, finding a boyfriend who looked like Zac Efron. I'm still on the hunt.
Still looking for Zac Efron.
Still, yeah. I've clearly set my standards too high.
Well, I've got no advice for you. I didn't back then, and I don't now. Jason Ball, you're a legend. Thank you so much for your generosity for coming in here and being on Word for Word.
Thank you, Ben.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Ben Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the community radio network.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.